I think we just have to recognize for the mutual interest, it's good to have a working relationship with each other as opposed to having frictions.
China 21 is produced by the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. We are a university-based think tank that produces original research to anchor major policy discussions on China and its relationship to the United States. This podcast features expert voices, insights, and stories about China's economy, politics, society, and the implications for international affairs. Learn more at china.ucsd.edu.
You know, it's a real pleasure to have you here, obviously. And, you know, the center here has been working very hard, but a big part of that is really to share stories with different folks who come in contact with the 21st Century China Center. And your story, obviously, is a very fascinating one. And so thank you for coming. You know, your book, Out of the Gobi, My Story of China and America, is a fabulous read. And, you know, I wanted just to start by asking why. Why now did you decide to write this book? What were you thinking about this is obviously a big effort to write a book like this.
I've been thinking about writing this book for many, many years. In fact, back when I was a professor at the Wharton School, I started to write it. And I wrote about 100 pages. But I got too busy, so I shelved it. But it never escaped my mind that someday I would pick it up. And back in 2017, I decided I had some time to do it. So I just wrote it up before I forget everything.
Right. And who is your audience in writing this? I mean, when you were kind of writing your story, who were you thinking about would be reading the story?
When I first wrote it, I thought, obviously, my audience would be Americans,
right,
who probably don't have much appreciation of what China went through in the past 50 years. And then after the book was published, I noticed that not only Americans, but there were many Chinese who are children of the people of my generation who went through the same experiences during the Cultural Revolution, and their children are very interested in knowing what happened in China 50 years ago. So I think that I have pretty broad base of readers today.
Right. You know, children like yours and mine, especially those who have not, who have necessarily gone to school in China for their schooling with local schools, much of this history is not detailed for them.
Yes.
So this book is really a wonderful chance for them to read a firsthand account, especially during these times, the 60s, even back further. I mean, one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book was that you have separate sections just to talk about historical context.
Yes.
And it's a wonderful history lesson. In fact, one of the first things that I wanted to ask you about were the letters between Mao and Roosevelt that you mentioned and that took place in the mid-1940s.
Yes.
This is a fascinating story. Maybe you can share a little bit with us the details of that and why you thought that was so important to bring out in the very beginning of your book.
Of course, China and America were allies during the war. And American government sent a special team to Yan'an, the communist headquarters in Shanxi province. So there was some relationship, but within the US government, there had always been two factions, one supporting the Kuomintang government, one more, I would say, pro the communists, but not really pro communists. They just thought that Mao's forces were a potent force against the Japanese invaders or in the war effort. So there was pretty good relationship between America and both governments, the Kuomintang government, the national government, and the communist government in Yan'an. And after the war, Mao really wished to develop a good relationship with the United States. And so he proposed to visit Washington together with Zhou Enlai, who later became the prime minister. But I think Hurdy, who was the ambassador to China at the time, never passed a letter to Roosevelt. But one letter that Mao sent to Roosevelt when Roosevelt was away to attend Tehran conference did reach Roosevelt, and he replied to the letter, which I refer to in the book.
Right.
But the offer to visit with him in Washington, that letter, to my understanding, was never passed to the president.
Right. You know, fast forwarding to the summer of 1966, the start of the Cultural Revolution. Much of your story talks about that time between, especially between 1966 and 1976. The great networking.
Yes.
Sounds like a fascinating trip. maybe you could share a little bit about that time during the summer of 1966.
1966 was when the Cultural Revolution broke out, and there was major shakeup in the government. The president of the country, Liu Shaoqi, was brought down and sent into prison in that year. And the Red Guards were destroying everything, beating up everyone. But it started in Beijing. And in August of 1966, Mao decided to meet or review the Red Guards in Tiananmen Square. And he did it a total of 8 times in that year, starting from August the 18th of 1966. He reviewed millions of Red Guards. He called upon them to spread the fire of revolution from Beijing to the rest of the country. Mm. That began the so-called Great Networking Movement. Mm. So Red Guards from Beijing just fanned out to different parts of China to stir up things, to start a revolution. And many Red Guards from outside Beijing, different provinces, came to Beijing to learn how to do the revolution. And I was 12 years old. Everybody could travel for free, and transportation, lodging, food were all provided for. I don't know by who, because the government was paralyzed at different levels at that time. But I traveled with a group of middle school students. I was only in primary school in many different parts of China. And it was a great experience for me. Mm.
In some ways, it sounded much like a pilgrimage. I mean, looking at the different places that you went.
Although there was no specific destination. You just wander around, roam around.
Shanghai, Fujian.
Right.
And then gradually making your way to Jiangxi. And
yes.
It's quite an adventure, especially at that age. Of course,
that was, of course, from my perspective, an interesting experience. But the entire country was brought to a standstill. All the production was shut down, and almost every figure in any kind of official capacity or authority capacity, like government officials or scholars in academics, were attacked verbally, sometimes physically, and all the schools were shut down. So the cost to the country, the cost to human lives, were enormous.
Yeah, you know, there are a number of really dedicated academics and teachers, and the two principals, one at the girls' 13th school, one at your own middle school,
yes.
Principal Lee, that you talk about their stories and the great tragedies of people who appeared to be such giving and dedicated educators for
yes.
the children.
Yes. In the month of August 1966 alone, about 1,700 middle school teachers were beaten to death by their students in Beijing, just in one city, 1,700, based on the numbers that I have seen. And I'm sure that's not a complete number. Hmm. It was a total chaos.
You know, that was in your book, you earlier in the book, you talk about this Li Xiaojiang, you know, in your middle school, who during very, very difficult times was somehow able to feed all of the children through just tremendous efforts and dedication. And then later, of course, during this period of the Cultural Revolution, it was obviously very tragic for her and her family.
She was thrown into prison, and she stayed in prison in solitary confinement for 8 years. For nothing that we could figure out.
You know, the book's title obviously references the Gobi Desert and your time in the Construction Army Corps, which started a few years later in 1969. And there are, you know, many stories there. I'd like to just touch on a few of them. One is the first.
Sure, the title is Out of the Gobi.
So right, yeah.
I talk about is really my experiences in the Gobi.
Yeah, and the first that comes to mind is the potato harvest.
Yes.
You know, maybe you can share a little bit about the
I just talked about the futility of it. You know, we were sent to dig potatoes, worked very hard, spent night in the fields in very cold weather, had to dig foxholes to spend the night. And, you know, we harvested a lot of potatoes. Eventually, nobody cared about them. So they were not transported out. And most of them just rotted away. So it was really a reflection of the futility of our hard labor over there for so many years. So many of us, teenagers working in the Gobi Desert, very hard work, and yet we were not doing anything productive. And it was a waste of human efforts, and more importantly, our youth.
You know, you underscored some of that wasted effort with some statistics. You talked about the harvest in your first year, this is 1969, of grain, of 70,000 kilograms, and at a farm that had previously produced 500,000 kilograms. So with this,
after we added 300 more people to it, and they used to have a couple of dozen people over there, maybe just 1,000 people producing 500,000, and then we added 300 people, a lot of fertilizers, a lot of mechanics, and then eventually we produced 70,000. So it was really just waste of resources.
And in terms of just seed alone, you compared the 750,000 kilograms of seed that you had used during that effort. I mean, it's just hard to
We would spread about 35 pounds of seeds per unit, per mu, the Chinese unit measurement of land. And we would harvest something like 14 ounces per mu. So again, we would have been much better off just to eat the seeds.
You know, another major initiative was the reed and canal efforts near the lake, near Lake Wuliangsu. And it was, you really not only highlighted the futility of the efforts during that time, but also your admiration for Dasheng. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could talk a little bit about Ding Dasheng and his role in your life during that time, and for that, you know, your group that was in that area working.
I think anybody listening to this will just have to read the book to get a full story of it. And it was just an example of the kind of people we were working over there, very dedicated, very hardworking. And this gentleman, who I call Da Sheng, was the squad leader. We were organized like a military, so he was the squad leader. He was just extremely hardworking. And I had to keep up with him, so it was very tough. And that's the experience that I described in the book.
One of the other pursuits that your team worked on was brickmaking.
Mm.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about that experience.
We had to do everything. We had to build houses, shelters for ourselves. Initially, it was simply mud and reeds because we had a lake not too far away from where we were, which grew reeds. So you mix reeds and mud, and then you make mud bricks. Incidentally, you know, in the Bible, when Moses got his people out of Egypt, God instructed them to make mud houses, shelters, and for those naughty ones, God would not give them reeds. Therefore, the brick would not be so strong.
Right.
So we initially had to make bricks with reeds and mud or clay, and eventually we made bricks with sand and clay mixed together. And finally, we fired the bricks in the kiln to make real bricks, baked bricks. It was hard. I mean, it's back-breaking job. It was extremely hard job. In the book, I described how back-breaking it was and how we would like to build a machine to basically save our energy and increase productivity, but for lack of capital, which was not much, about 3,000 yuan at the time, we just couldn't do it. So we had to continue to make bricks with our bare hands and with our backs.
You know, during that time, you had the opportunity to become a barefoot doctor.
I did become.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your experiences as a barefoot doctor. There were two very moving experiences in particular. That one was the young boy, and of course the other was the inoculations, the vaccines that really struck my memory. I don't know. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your experiences.
I think that if there's anything that's positive coming out of the Cultural Revolution, it was the barefoot doctor system, because there was total lack of medicine in the countryside in China. So the system was to allow some so-called educated youth, that is, those like myself who had only been to primary school, to receive some basic medical training and to become a barefoot doctor and to treat everyday ailments. So in the book, I talked about how I was trained, how I was appointed, you know, out of the blue, with no process to speak of, just the company leader. Again, we were organized like a military, so ours was company, platoon and squad. Company leader just decided to send me for medical training. And after a couple of months, I came back and became a doctor. And the two cases I described in the book, number one was when a child was very sick, came down with pneumonia. Fortunately, it was bacterial pneumonia, so antibiotics was effective. And we treated him and saved his life, which was extremely gratifying to me, to see that whatever training that we got, even though basic, has some effect. And the second was when we had to inoculate everybody against swine plague. I don't know why it's called swine plague, but it came from rats, which broke out in one corner of Inner Mongolia, and therefore everybody would have to get vaccinated. But the instruction on the label, on the vial of the vaccine, was misprinted. So we overdosed everyone and almost killed the entire company of 300 people. But fortunately, we were all teenagers, and so with a very strong constitution, so everybody survived, but not until after suffering severe plague-like symptoms.
The one of the lighter moments of the story, you referred to was this with regard to sports, and in particular your desire to, I guess, gain the respect of your peers in some ways by studying the rules of volleyball.
Yes.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, it was really my way to become popular. The reason I wanted to be popular was because in order to go to college, you had to be elected. And I was studying all the time by myself, and therefore I was not so popular with the people. And since people didn't really see me, I didn't spend enough time with the people. But in order to win this election, being elected to go to college, I had to launch my own campaign. And I noticed that sports was a popular thing to do, but I was not very good with either basketball or volleyball. So I trained myself to become a referee for volleyball, sitting very high over the net and looking at the entire fields. And there are many spectators, so I became very noticed. And eventually, when it came to election for college, I got the second highest number of votes. but I was rejected by the leaders anyway, so I was not able to get to college.
In September of 1975, you finally had that opportunity. And you tell the story about your visiting another one of your friends, Wang Dacheng, in the next room was the telephone switchboard.
Yes.
After now 6 years in the Gobi, how did you feel at that moment in time? And maybe you can describe the setting.
Well, I was visiting with him, and he was in charge of irrigation project in the sub headquarters of the regiment. And I was, of course, with an agricultural company. And we were chatting, and his next door was the switchboard where two girls were working there. They were also Construction Army Corps members. And they knew him, and they also had a nodding acquaintance with myself, and they knew we were there. So they, in the middle of our conversation, one of the girls came over and breached some highly classified military secrets. On the phone, the operators, the two of them, heard that the regiment was reading a list of people that who were approved to go to college to the company where I was a soldier, or so-called soldier. We were not in real military, but it was kind of quasi-military. So she came over to tell me that I was selected, and I was elated. I was so excited. I thought that my time finally came. That was a big moment in my life.
How did you feel? I mean, this must have been quite an amazing day for you.
Yes, I felt, of course, very excited, very happy. And initially, I reacted that way. I jumped onto a horseback. I came with a horse, and I was rushing back to the company because I knew the news was already there, and I would be notified. I was galloping the horse, and then I suddenly realized if I die by falling off the horseback at this particular moment, that would be the biggest tragic of all times. So I basically let go of the horse. I jumped off. I walked calmly back to the company campus on the barracks. But I was very anxious that the leadership would change its mind. So after I was notified, I left the company immediately on the same day without stopping. Took a train, traveled about 50 kilometers to the train station and took a train to get out of the Gobi get out of Inner Mongolia on that very same day. Many years after that, almost every night, I would dream, I would have a nightmare that letting me go was a total mistake. It was misunderstanding, I had to go back. Mm. And that's how anxious I was. For years and years, even after I got into America, I would have this dream, recurring dream. Right. I've not had that dream in recent years. No.
That you would wake up and suddenly be back in the Gobi.
No, I would wake up to realize that I was not in the Gobi. Every time, I would be so happy.
Right. I wanted to talk about bricks again.
Yes.
Because you tell a very touching story about the Kazoos and their support of you. And also at University of San Francisco, the brick that you received.
Yes.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, I was very generously supported by the professors at University of San Francisco when I first came to the United States. And a Mrs. Kasu and her husband, Mrs. Kasu was the associate dean of the law school where I was studying. Her husband, Phil Kasu, anonymously gave some money to the university to cover my tuition fees to allow me to get my first master's degree. So years later, I gave back to the university with a modest donation. And as a token of appreciation, the university gave me a piece of brick, which was the foundation brick of St. Ignatius College, which was the predecessor of University of San Francisco, which was destroyed in 1906 by the great earthquake of San Francisco. The brick bears a cross. It turned out when the college was first built, the contract went to Chinese laborers, but the Irish or the white laborers protested. And it was at the time when the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed. So there was very strong anti-Chinese sentiment. So eventually the school authorities divided the contract to build the college into two parts, one part to give to the Chinese laborers, one part to European laborers. And the European laborers, in order to differentiate themselves from the Chinese laborers and also to show some superiority, carved a cross on each of the bricks that they made. And one of them was given to me as token of appreciation for my contribution to the university. So I thought it was a very ironic turn in history.
And underscored by your own brick-making experience in
yes.
the Gobi.
Yes.
You know, you had the opportunity to get your PhD at Berkeley, where you spent the greater part of 1982 to 1986. At that time, Berkeley was continuing its reputation as being at the forefront of
it was People's
engagement.
Republic of Berkeley.
Yeah. Maybe just talk a little bit about your time at Berkeley.
No, it was a very vibrant place.
Right.
It was very liberal, and it was very open. So it was a great place to learn different things. Mm. And American liberalism was on full display at UC Berkeley. You walk into the bookstore, you see two big portraits. Einstein, Albert Einstein was one of them. The other one was Karl Marx, right? And outside of the bookstore, there was a big banner which reads, "All things reactionary are the same. Where the broom doesn't reach, the dust will not rid of itself. Chairman Mao."
Right.
That big banner outside of the bookstore. So when I got into Berkeley, I said, wow, I'm back to the Cultural Revolution here in the United States.
Mm. You later traveled to the East Coast, first briefly at the World Bank and then to Wharton. And during your time at Wharton, you tell the story about Tiananmen and the interview that you were taking place on the evening of June 3rd. Would you like to share a little bit about that story?
I think the TV interviewer asked me whether or not I thought the troops would open fire. And I said, absolutely not. I didn't think it was possible. And I started to give reasons why I didn't think it was not possible. And this shows the risk of making predictions. In the middle of the interview, he showed me a cable which says that troops opened fire in Beijing. That was quite a devastating moment for me.
Later in your career, you were at J.P. Morgan and TPG and now PAG. You had spent quite a bit of time as an academic, but then as an investor yourself. You tell the story about visiting Columbia University and participating in a case study discussion of one of your investments. I was actually just curious to what investment that was.
I have been a private equity investor for the past 20 years, and we bought a bank called Korea First Bank, which was at one time the largest bank in Korea. It was the most iconic bank in Korea, which failed in 1997 in the middle of Asia financial crisis. And I was a co-managing partner at Newbridge Capital, which was the Asian franchise of TPG, Texas Pacific Group, as its name was known at that time. And we bought control of that bank from the Korean government, which had nationalized the bank. So the experience, early part of the experience, was written into a Harvard Business School case, which is taught by a number of business schools. So I met with a group of Columbia students. I was not on Columbia campus for that particular event, who asked me questions about the case. And I told them that the case writer didn't really understand what was going on. And then they told me how their professor interpreted the case. And I simply said, don't believe always your professors. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. And in that particular case, the interpretation given by the professor was not correct.
You know, I think that in the book, you know, the context of you bringing the story up was really just in terms of this idea of practice, you know,
yes.
for academics to be close to practice,
yes.
Especially academics who are involved in business or the economic world, of studying economies and development. If you were to give advice to a professor, either here or other universities, especially young professors who are PhD students, how would you encourage them to be closer to practice, like you were feeling was very important?
I think as a business and economics professor, it helps to have some practical experiences so that you actually know what you're talking about. But I sometimes joke that if you don't know how to do it, you teach it. But the point is, as a professor, you don't really have to have practical experience because you can't really match the experiences of your students. Let's say if you're a professor of MBA students, many of them have had many years of work experience. You wouldn't expect a professor to have similar experiences. What the professor is good at is to take abstract out of your experience and then make some sense out of it, to generalize it. You know, you may have had the experience, but you don't know why you do it in such a way. You know how to do it in such a way, but you don't know why you do it in such a way. And therefore, your way to apply the experience is rather limited. Whereas from a theoretical point of view, a professor will be able to extract that experience and put it into context of a general, say, theory. so you better understand the implications of that particular experience. You will, after learning from the professor, you will be able to better apply that experience. And that's what professors do. They don't necessarily have to practice.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, today.
But of course, if you've had some business experience, it also helps.
Right. Yeah. Of course. And you have the chance now to bridge both worlds in a very effective way. And, you know, today, the U.S.-China relations are at a difficult juncture. I'd be interested to hear your perspective as to why that may be the case and where you see the future going between these two countries.
I think it's unfortunate the relationship is what it is now, which, as you describe, is rather difficult, and there's a lot of tension. I would expect the tension to continue. I think that the relationship can get worse, and I don't know whether or not it will get better. I think we just have to recognize that there is a mutual interest between the two countries. And for the mutual interest, it's good to have a working relationship with each other as opposed to having frictions. We, you and I, have been through this in the past 40 years, since more than 40 years, I would say 50 years, since Nixon first visited. Mm. Nixon visited in 1972. At the time, China was a centrally planned system. It was political dictatorship, and Chairman Mao was ruling the country. There was no resemblance between China and the United States. And yet, the two countries find common interest to develop a relationship. And I would say in the subsequent years, the relationship became warmer and warmer, culminating into the establishment of the diplomatic relationship in 1979 under Jimmy Carter. And today, I would say there's much more commonality between China and the United States. And today, each of the two countries is the largest trading partner of the other. And there's so much economic integration between the two countries that if one country suffers economically, the other country is severely affected as well. Take, for example, semiconductor industry. There's arguably some kind of a technology war between China and the United States. There was argument that China or America should withhold supply of semiconductor chips, especially high-end chips, to some of the Chinese users. But American top 10 semiconductor manufacturers sell three times as much in China as in the United States. So if you don't sell to Chinese buyers, is a self-defeating proposition. You lose revenue, you lose income, you lose R&D spending, and eventually it will affect your innovative capability and your ability to keep the cutting edge in technology. So recognizing it, I think the friction will continue, but we have to recognize that there's a mutual benefit to have a relationship. China now is the largest retail market in the world, larger than the United States. And that is a very dramatic change. Even since 10 years ago, in 2009, China's retail market size was $1.8 trillion. America's was $4 trillion. Last year, China's was more than $6 trillion. America was $6 trillion as well, but China was slightly larger. Such being the case, you know, China is a big market for American companies. I hope people recognize that potential and will take advantage of that potential.
You know, you have, in many ways, one foot in both countries.
Yes.
In terms of the time that you spent, obviously growing up in China, but being your higher education was here in the United States. Today, you go back and forth quite regularly. What would your advice be to others like you who are actively engaged in China today in trying to move this dialogue forward in a more productive and constructive way between the two countries?
A lot of policies, actions, rhetoric are based on ignorance of each other. I think the best way to make informed decisions is to be informed. And therefore, I think a research institution like University of California, San Diego, with its 21st Century China Center, is extremely useful in studying the issues, spreading the knowledge, collecting the data, and informing the market, the policymakers, so that all parties can make smart decisions for their own benefit, for their own self-interest. I think that's the only way to help improve the relationship between the two countries.
You know, we expect that there will be some students coming this afternoon, college students. There are quite a few college students. I think it's close to 5,000 students from China. I mean, these are students who, let's just say, Chinese students who have come to America in some ways like you, but many at an earlier age. And let's just say, you know, today China is a very popular area for Americans to study too, including the language, Chinese language. You know, these are students that have an interest in China, have an interest obviously in the United States as well. What words of advice would you give to them for their future as they think about their next steps?
I have to be very broad and general.
Yeah.
And in general, my philosophy in life is to be always prepared, because you never know when and where the next opportunity will be. You want to be prepared so that when the opportunity arises, you will be able to capture it, which means you should get as broad an education as possible. You should get as broad a knowledge base as possible. So just study, you know, everything that you're interested in, and have a good liberal art basis. And you know, that's what I advise young people. And that's the only way to do it in life. It's a great pleasure to be here. I really enjoy visiting the campus. And I think the university and the center are doing a very good work in research. And I wish you best of luck.
Well, thank you, Meijian, for taking the time to be here. And we're looking forward to your talk later today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to China 21, the podcast of the 21st Century China Center at UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Visit china.ucsd.edu and connect with us on social media. 谢谢大家.